Kerrigan, Paul, come along, the old man said tersely, and started along the log street. Oddly, the she-wolf accompanied them. Why the sudden curiosity, father? Palgra asked, when they were out of earshot. I want to find out just how effective this curse the Dals have laid around Kel really is. If it is something that can be overcome, we might run into Zendromos when we get there after all. They found the Grolem sitting on the floor in his tent. The harsh angularity of his face had softened, and his sightless eyes had lost the burning fanaticism common to all Grolems. His face, instead, was filled with a kind of wonder. How is it with you, friend? Belgoroth asked him gently.
I am content, the Grolem replied.
The word seemed peculiar, coming from the mouth of a priest of Torak. Why is it that you tried to approach Kel? Didn't you know about the curse?
It is not a curse. It is a blessing.
A blessing?
I was ordered by the sorceress Zendromos to try to reach the holy city of the Dals, the Grolem continued. She told me that I would be exalted should I be successful.
He smiled gently.
It was in her mind, I think, to test the strength of the enchantment, to determine if it might be safe for her to attempt the journey.
I gather that it would not be.
That is difficult to say. Great benefit might come to her if she tried.
I would hardly call going blind a benefit.
But I am not blind.
I thought that's what the enchantment was all about.
Oh, no. I cannot see the world around me. But that is because I see something else. Something that fills my heart with joy.
Oh, what is that?
I see the face of God, my friend, and well until the end of my days.
Chapter 3 It was always there. Even when they were in deep, cool forests, they could feel it looming over them, still and white and serene. The mountain filled their eyes, their thoughts, and even their dreams. Silk grew increasingly irritable as they rode day after day toward that gleaming, white enormity.
How can anyone possibly get anything done in this part of the world with that thing there filling up half the sky? He burst out one sunny afternoon.
Perhaps they ignore it, Keldar,
Velvet said sweetly.
How can you ignore something that big? He retorted.
I wonder if it knows how ostentatious and even vulgar it is.
You are being irrational, she said. The mountain doesn't care how we feel about it. It's going to be there long after we are all gone.
She paused.
Is that what bothers you, Keldar? Coming across something permanent in the middle of a transient life?
The stars are permanent, he pointed out. So is dirt, for that matter. But they don't intrude the way that beast does.
He looked at Zakath.
Has anybody ever climbed to the top of it?
Why would anybody want to?
To beat it. To reduce it, Silk laughed. That's even more irrational, isn't it?
Zakath, however, was looking speculatively at the looming presence that filled the southern sky.
I don't know, Keldar. I have never considered the possibility of fighting a mountain before. It is easy to beat men. To beat a mountain, though. Now, that is something else.
Would it care?
Eriond asked. The young man so seldom spoke that he seemed at times to be as mute as Toth. He had, of late, however, seemed even more withdrawn.
The mountain might even welcome you, he smiled gently. I would imagine it gets lonesome. It could even want to share what it sees with anyone brave enough to go up there and look.
Zakath and Silk exchanged a long, almost hungry look.
You'd need ropes, Silk said in a neutral sort of tone.
And probably certain kinds of tools as well,
Zakath added.
Things that would dig into the ice and hold you while you climbed up higher.
Danik could figure those out for us.
Will you two stop that? Polgara said tartly. We have other things to think about right now.
It's just speculation, Polgara, Silk said lightly. This business of ours won't last forever. And when it's over, well, who knows?
They were all subtly changed by the mountain. Speech seemed less and less necessary, and they all thought long thoughts, which, during quiet times around the campfire at night, they tried to share with each other. It became somehow a time of cleansing and healing, and they all grew closer together as they approached that solitary immensity. One night, Geryon awoke with a light as bright as day in his eyes. He slipped out from under the blankets and turned back the flap of the tent. A full moon had arisen, and it filled the world with a pale luminescence. The mountain stood stark and white against the starry blackness of the night sky, glowing with a cool incandescence that seemed almost alive. A movement caught his eye. Aunt Paul emerged from the tent she shared with Dernick. She wore a white robe that seemed almost a reflection of the moon-washed mountain. She stood for a moment in silent contemplation, then turned slightly.
Dernick, she murmured softly. Come and look.
Dernick emerged from the tent. He was bare-chested, and his silver amulet glittered in the moonlight. He put his arm about Polgara's shoulders, and the two of them stood drinking in the beauty of this most perfect of nights. Geryon was about to call out to them, but something stayed his tongue. The moment they were sharing was too private to be intruded upon. After quite some time, Aunt Paul whispered something to her husband, and, smiling, the two of them turned and went hand in hand back into their tent. Quietly, Geryon let the tent flap drop and went back to his blankets. Slowly, as they continued in a generally southwesterly direction, the forest changed. When they were still in the mountains, the trees had been evergreens interspersed here and there with aspens. As they approached the lowlands at the base of the huge mountain, they increasingly came across groves of beech and elm. And then at last, they entered a forest of ancient oaks. As they rode beneath the spreading branches in sun-dappled shade, Geryon was sharply reminded of the wood of the dryads in southern Tol Nedra. One glance at his little wife's face revealed that the similarity was not lost on her either. A kind of dreamy contentment came over her, and she seemed to be listening to voices that only she could hear. It was about noon on a splendid summer day that they overtook another traveler, a white-bearded man dressed in clothing made from deerskin. The handles of the tools protruding from the lumpy bundle on the back of his pack mule proclaimed him to be a gold hunter, one of those vagrant hermits who haunt wildernesses the world over. He was riding a shaggy mountain pony so stumpy that its rider's feet nearly touched the ground on either side.
"I thought I heard somebody coming up from behind," the gold hunter said, as Geryon and Zakath, both in their mail shirts and helmets, drew alongside him. "Don't see many in these woods, what with the curse and all."
"I thought the curse only worked on Grolems," Geryon said.
"Most believe it doesn't pay to take chances. Where are you bound?"
"To Kel,"
Geryon replied. There was no real point in making a secret of it.
"I hope you've been invited. The folk at Kel don't welcome strangers who just take it upon themselves to go there."
"They know we are coming."
"Oh, that's all right, then. Strange place, Kel, and strange people. Of course, living right under that mountain the way they do would make anybody strange after a while. If it's all right, I'll ride along with you as far as the turnoff to Balassa, a couple of miles on up ahead.
Feel free, Zakath told him. Aren't you missing a good time to be looking for gold, though?
Got myself caught up in the mountains last winter, the old fellow replied. Supplies ran out on me. Besides, I get hungry for talk now and then. The pony and the mule ain't listen pretty good, but they don't answer very well. And the wolves up there move around so much you can't hardly get a conversation started with them.
He looked at the she-wolf and then astonishingly spoke to her in her own language.
How is it with you, mother?
He asked. His accent was abominable, and he spoke haltingly, but his speech was undeniably that of a wolf.
How remarkable,
she said with some surprise. Then she responded to the ritual greeting.
One is content.
One's pleased to hear that. How is it that you go with the man things?
One has joined their pack for a certain time.
Ah.
How did you manage to learn the language of wolves? Garion asked in some amazement.
You recognized it then?
The old fellow sounded pleased about that for some reason. He leaned back in his saddle.
Spent most my life up there where the wolves are, he explained. It's only polite to learn the language of your neighbors, he grinned. To be honest about it, though, at first I couldn't make much of it out. But if you listen hard enough, it starts to come to you. Spent a winter in a den with a pack of them about 5 years back. That helped quite a bit.
They actually let you live with them?
Zakath asked.
It took them a while to get used to me, the old man admitted. But I made myself useful, so they sort of accepted me.
Useful?
And the den was a little crowded, and I got them their tools.
He jerked his thumb at his pack mule.
I dug the den out some larger, and they seemed to appreciate it. Then, after a while, I took to watching over the pups while the rest was out hunting. Good pups they was, too, playful as kittens. Some time later, I tried to make up to a bear. Never had much luck with that. Bears are a standoffish bunch. They keep to their shells most of the time, and deer are just too skittish to try to make friends with. Give me wolves every time.
The old gold hunter's pony did not move very fast, so the others soon caught up with them.
Any luck?
Silk asked the old gold hunter, his nose twitching with interest.
Some,
the white-bearded man answered evasively.
Oh, sorry, Silk apologized. I didn't mean to pry.
It's all right, friend. I can see that you're an honest man.
Velvet muffled a slightly derisive chuckle.
It's just a habit I picked up, the fellow continued. Not really too smart to go around telling everybody how much gold you've managed to pick up.
Oh, I can certainly understand that.
I don't usually carry that much with me when I come down into the low country, though. Only to pay for what I need. Leave the rest of it hid back up there in the mountains.
Why do you do it, then? Turnick asked.
Spend all your time looking for gold, I mean. You don't spend it, so why bother? It's something to do, the fellow shrugged. And it gives me an excuse to be up there in the mountains. A man feels sort of frivolous if he does that with no reason, he grinned again. And, too, there's a certain kind of excitement that comes with finding a pocket of gold in a stream bed. Like some say, finding is more fun than spending, and gold's sort of pretty to look at.
Oh, it is indeed, Silk agreed fervently. The old gold hunter glanced at the she-wolf and then looked at Belgorath.
I can see by the way she's acting that you're the leader of this group, he noted.
Belgorath looked a bit startled at that.
He's learned the language,
Garion explained.
How remarkable,
Belgorath said, unconsciously echoing the comment of the wolf.
I was going to pass on some advice to these two young fellows, but you're the one who probably ought to hear it.
I will certainly listen,
The Dowls are a peculiar sort, friend. They've got some peculiar superstitions. I won't go so far as to say they think of these woods as sacred, but they do feel pretty strongly about them. I wouldn't advise cutting any trees, and don't, whatever you do, kill anything or anybody here.
He pointed at the wolf.
She knows about that already. You've probably noticed that she won't hunt here. The Dolls don't want this forest profaned with blood. I'd respect that if I were you. The Dolls can be helpful, but if you offend their beliefs, they can make things mighty difficult for you.
I appreciate the information, Belgarath told him.
Never hurts a man to pass on things he's picked up, the old fellow said.
He looked up the track.
Well, he said, this is as far as I go. That's the road to Balassa, just on up ahead. Been nice talking with you.
He doffed his shabby hat politely to Polgara, then looked at the wolf.
Be well, mother, he said.
Then he thumped his heels against his pony's flanks. The pony broke into an ambling sort of trot and jolted around a bend in the road to Balassa and out of sight.
Was he delightful, old man?
Tenedra said. Useful, too, Polgara added. You had better get in touch with Uncle Belden, father. Tell him to leave the rabbits and pigeons alone while we are in this forest.
I had forgotten about that, he said. I'll take care of it right now.
He lifted his face and closed his eyes.
Can that old fellow really talk with wolves? Silk asked Geryon. He knows the language, Geryon replied. He doesn't speak it very well, but he knows it.
One is sure he understands better than he speaks, the she-wolf said.
Geryon stared at her, slightly startled that she had understood the conversation.
The language of the man-things is not difficult to learn, she said. As the man-thing with the white fur on his face said, one can learn rapidly if one takes the trouble to listen. One would not care to speak your language, however, she added critically. The speech of the man-things would place one's tongue in much danger of being bitten.
A sudden thought came to Geryon then, accompanied by an absolute certainty that the thought was entirely accurate.
Grandfather, he said.
Not now, Geryon. I'm busy.
I'll wait.
Is it important?
I think so, yes.
Belgarath opened his eyes curiously.
What is it?
He asked.
Do you remember that conversation we had in Tol Hanath, the morning it was snowing?
I think so.
We were talking about the way everything that happened seemed to have happened before?
Yes, now I remember.
You said that when the two prophecies got separated, things sort of stopped, that the future can't happen until they get back together again. Then you said that until they do, we'd all have to keep going through the same series of events over and over again.
Did I really say that?
The old man looked a bit pleased.
That's sort of profound, isn't it? What's the point of this, though? Why are you bringing it up now?
Because I think it just happened again.
Geryon looked at Silk.
Do you remember that gold hunter we met in Gorognadrak, when the three of us were on our way to Tol Mishrak?
Silk nodded a bit dubiously.
Wasn't the old fellow we just talked with almost exactly the same?
Now that you mention it,
Silk's eyes narrowed.
All right, Belgarath, what does it mean?
Belgarath squinted up at the leafy branches overhead.
Let me think about it for a minute. There are some similarities, all right, he admitted. The two of them are the same kind of people, and they both warned us about something. I think I had better get Belden back here. This might be very important.
It was no more than a quarter of an hour later when the blue-banded hawk settled out of the sky and blurred into the misshapen sorcerer.
What's got you so excited? He demanded crossly.
We just met somebody,
Belgarath replied.
Now, congratulations.
I think this is serious, Belden. Belgarath quickly explained his theory of recurring events.
It's a little rudimentary, Belden growled. But there's nothing remarkable about that. Your hypotheses usually are, he squinted. It's probably fairly accurate, though, as far as it goes.
Thanks, Belgarath said dryly. Then he went on to describe the two meetings, the one in Gorognadrak and the other here. The similarities are a little striking, aren't they?
Coincidence?
Shrugging things off as coincidence is the best way I know of to get into trouble.
All right. For the sake of argument, let's say it wasn't coincidence.
The dwarf squatted in the dirt at the roadside, his face twisted in thought.
Why don't we take this theory of yours a step farther? He mused. Let's look at the notion that these repetitions crop up at significant points in the course of events.
Sort of like signposts, Dernick suggested.
Exactly. I couldn't have found a better term myself. Let's suppose that these signposts point at really important things that are right on the verge of happening, that they're sort of like warnings.
I'm hearing a lot of notions and supposes, Silk said skeptically. I think you are off into the realm of pure speculation.
You're a brave man, Geldar, Belden said sardonically. Something could be trying to warn you about a potential catastrophe, and you choose to ignore the warning. That's either very brave or very stupid. Of course, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt by using the word brave instead of the other one.
One for his side,
Velvet murmured. Silk flushed slightly.
But how do we know what it is that's going to happen? He objected.
We don't, Belgarath said. The circumstances just call for some extra alertness, is all. We have been warned. The rest is up to us.
They took some special precautions when they set up their encampment that evening. Polgara prepared supper quickly, and the fire was extinguished as soon as they had finished eating. Garion and Silk took the first watch. They stood atop a knoll behind the camp, peering into the darkness.
I hate this, Silk whispered.
Hate what?
Knowing that something is going to happen without knowing what it is. I wish those two old men would keep their speculations to themselves.
Do you really like surprises?
A surprise is better than living with a sense of dread. My nerves aren't what they used to be.
You are too high-strung sometimes. Look at all of the entertainment you're getting out of anticipation.
I'm terribly disappointed in you, Garion. I thought you were a nice, sensible boy.
What did I say?
Anticipation. In this situation, that's just another word for worry. And worry is not good for anybody.
It's just a way to get us ready in case something happens.
Oh, I'm always ready, Garion. That's how I've managed to live so long. But right now, I feel almost as tightly wound as a lute string.
Try not to think about it.
Of course, Silk retorted sarcastically.
But doesn't that defeat the purpose of the warning? Aren't we supposed to think about it?
The sun had not come up yet when Sadi came back to their camp, moving very quietly and going from tent to tent with a whispering warning.
There's somebody out there, he warned, after he had scratched on the flap of Garion's tent.
Garion rolled out from under his blankets, his hand automatically reaching for his sword. He paused then. The old gold hunter had warned them against the shedding of blood. Was this the event for which they had been waiting? But were they supposed to obey the prohibition, or to step over it in response to some higher need? There was not time now to stand locked in indecision, however. Sword in hand, Garion rushed from the tent. The light had that peculiar steely tint that comes from a colorless sky before the sun rises. It cast no shadows, and what lay beneath the broad spread oaks was not so much darkness as it was a fainter light. Garion moved quickly, his feet avoiding almost on their own the windrows of years-old dead leaves and the fallen twigs and branches that littered the floor of this ancient forest. Zakath stood atop the knoll holding his sword.
"Where are they?"
Garion's voice was not so much a whisper as a breath.
"We were coming up from the south,"
Zakath whispered back.
"How many?"
"It's hard to say."
"Are they trying to sneak up on us?"
"It didn't really look that way. The ones we saw could have hidden back there among the trees, but they just came walking through the forest."
Garion peered out into the growing light, and then he saw them. They were dressed all in white, robes or long smocks, and they made no attempts at concealment. Their movements were deliberate, and seemed to have a placid, unhurried calm about them. They came in single file, each following the one in front at a distance of about 10 yards. There was something hauntingly familiar about the way they moved through the forest.
"All they need are the torches," Silk said from directly behind Garion.
The little man made no attempt to keep his voice down.
"Be still,"
Zakath hissed. "Why, they know we are here," Silk laughed a caustic little laugh. "Remember that time on the Isle of Akkad?" he said to Garion. "You and I spent a half hour or so crawling through the wet grass, following Vard and his people, and I'm absolutely sure now that they knew we were there all the time. We could have just walked along behind them and saved ourselves all of that discomfort."
"What are you talking about, Keldar?"
Zakath demanded in a hoarse whisper.
"This is another of Belgarath's repetitions," Silk shrugged. "Garion and I have been through it before." He sighed ruefully. "Life is going to get terribly boring if nothing new ever happens."
And then he raised his voice to a shout.
"We are over here,"
he called to the white-robed figures out in the forest.
"Are you mad?"
Zakath exclaimed. "Probably not. But then crazy people never really know, now do they? Those people are Dals, and I seriously doubt that any Dal has ever hurt anybody since the beginning of time." The leader of the strange column halted at the foot of the knoll and pushed back the cowl of his white robe.
"We have been awaiting you," he announced. "The Holy Seeress has sent us to see you safely to Kel."
Chapter 4. King Kiva of Drasnia was irritable that morning. He had overheard a conversation the previous evening between his mother and an emissary of King Anheg of Kerik, and his irritation grew out of a sort of moral dilemma. To reveal to his mother that he had been eavesdropping would, of course, be quite out of the question, and so he could not discuss with her what he had heard until she broached the subject herself. It seemed quite unlikely that she would do so, and so Kiva was at an impasse. It should be stated here that King Kiva was not really the sort of boy who would normally intrude on his mother's privacy. He was, basically, a decent lad. But he was also a Drasnian. There was a national trait among Drasnians which, for want of a better term, might be called curiosity. All people are curious to a certain degree, but in Drasnians the trait was quite nearly compulsive. Some contended that it was their innate curiosity which has made spying their national industry. Others maintained with equal vigor that the generations of spying had honed the Drasnians' natural curiosity to a fine edge. The debate was much like the endless argument about the chicken and the egg, and almost as pointless. Quite early in life, Kiva had trailed unobtrusively along behind one of the official court spies and thereby discovered the closet hidden behind the east wall of his mother's sitting room. Periodically he would slip into that closet in order to keep track of affairs of state and any other matters of interest. He was the king, after all, and thus he had a perfect right to the information. He reasoned that by spying he could obtain it while sparing his mother the inconvenience of passing it on to him. Kiva was a considerate boy. The conversation in question had concerned the mysterious disappearance of the Earl of Trelheim, his ship Seabird, and a number of other individuals, including Trelheim's son, Unrak. Beric, Earl of Trelheim, was considered in some quarters to be an unreliable sort, and his companions in this vanishing were, if anything, even worse. The Aelorn kings were disquieted by the potential for disaster, represented by Beric and his cohorts roaming loose in the gods only knew what ocean. What concerned young King Kiva, however, was not so much random disasters, as it was the fact that his friend Unrak had been invited to participate while he had not. The injustice of that rankled. The fact that he was a king seemed to automatically exclude him from anything that could even remotely be considered hazardous. Everyone went out of his way to keep Kiva safe and secure. But Kiva did not want to be kept safe and secure. Safety and security were boring, and Kiva was at an age where he would go to any lengths to avoid boredom. Clad all in red, he made his way through the marble halls of the palace in Boktor that winter morning. He stepped in front of the large tapestry and made some show of examining it. Then, at least relatively sure that no one was watching, this was Drasnia, after all, he slipped behind the tapestry and into the small closet previously mentioned. His mother was conferring with the Nadrek girl Vela and with Yarblik, Prince Keldar's shabby partner. Vela always made King Kiva nervous. She aroused certain feelings in him, with which he was not yet prepared to cope, and so he customarily avoided her. Yarblik, on the other hand, could be quite amusing. His speech was blunt and often colorful, and laced with oaths Kiva was not supposed to know the meaning of.
"They'll turn up, Porin," Yarblik was assuring Kiva's mother. "Beric just got bored, that's all."
"I wouldn't be so concerned if he'd gotten bored by himself," Queen Porin replied. "But the fact that this boredom seems to be an epidemic worries me. Beric's companions aren't the most stable men in the world."
"I've met them," Yarblik grunted. "You might just be right."
He paced up and down for a moment.
"I'll have our people keep an eye out for them."
"Yarblik, I've got the finest intelligence service in the world."
"Perhaps so, Porin. But Silk and I have more men than you do. And we've got offices and warehouses in places Javelin hasn't even heard of."
He looked at Vela.
"Do you want to go back to Gorok Nadrak with me?" he asked.
"In the winter time?"
Porin objected.
"We'll just wear more clothes, that's all," Yarblik shrugged.
"What are you going to do there?"
Vela asked.
"I'm not really very interested in sitting around listening to you talk business."
"I thought we'd go to Yar Nadrak. Javelin's people don't seem to be having much luck finding out what Thrasta's up to."
He broke off and looked speculatively at Queen Porin.
"Unless they've picked up something lately that I haven't heard about yet."
"Would I keep secrets from you, Yarblik?"
she asked with mock innocence.
"Probably, yes. If you've got something, Porin, share it with me. I don't want to make the trip for nothing, and Yar Nadrak's a miserable place in the winter."
"Nothing yet,"
she replied seriously. Yarblik grunted.
"I didn't think so. Drasnians look too much like Drasnians to be able to move around in Yar Nadrak without attracting attention."
He glanced at Vela.
"Well?" he asked.
"Why not?"
she agreed.
"Don't take this personally, Porin, but this project of yours, trying to turn me into a lady, is starting to distract me just a little. Would you believe that yesterday I left my room with only one of my daggers? I think I need some fresh air and stale beer to clear my head."
Kiva's mother sighed.
Try not to forget everything I've taught you, Vella.
I have a very good memory. I can tell the difference between Bokhtor and Yarnadrak. Bokhtor smells better, for one thing.
How long will you be gone?
Porin asked the rangy Yarblek.
Oh, a month or two, I'd imagine. I think we'll want to go to Yarnadrak by a roundabout route. I don't want to announce to Drosta that I'm coming.
All right, then,
the queen agreed. Then she thought of something.
One last thing, Yarblek.
Yes?
I am very fond of Vella. Don't make the mistake of selling her while you are in Gorognadrak. I would be very put out if you did that.
Who'd buy her?
Yarblek responded. Then he grinned and skipped out of the way as Vella automatically went for one of her daggers. Eternal Salmisra looked with some distaste at her current chief eunuch, Addis. In addition to being incompetent, Addis was slovenly. His iridescent robe was food-spotted, and his scalp and face were sparsely stubbled. He had never, she concluded, been more than an opportunist. And now that he had ascended to the position of chief eunuch, and felt more or less secure there, he had given himself over to the grossest sorts of debauchery. He consumed staggering quantities of some of the most pernicious drugs available in Naissa, and frequently came into her presence with the vacant-eyed shamble of a sleepwalker. He bathed infrequently, and the combination of the climate of Stithistor and the various drugs he used gave his body a rank, almost rancid odor. Since the Serpent Queen now sampled the air with her flickering tongue, she could not only smell him, but also taste him. He groveled on the marble floor before the dais, delivering a report on some unimportant matter in a whining, nasal voice. Unimportant matters filled the chief eunuch's days. He devoted himself to petty things, since significant things were beyond his capabilities. With the mindless concentration of a man with severely limited talents, he expanded the trivial out of all proportion and reported it as if it were of earth-shaking importance. Most of the time, Salmisra suspected he was blithely ignorant of the things that should really be receiving his full attention.
"That will be all, Addis,"
she told him in her sibilant whisper, her coils moving restlessly on her divan-like throne.
"But my queen,"
he protested, the half-dozen or so drugs he had taken since breakfast making him brave.
"This matter is of utmost urgency. To you, perhaps, I am indifferent to it. Hire an assassin to cut off the satrap's head and have done with it."
Addis stared at her in consternation.
"But Eternal Salmisra,"
he squeaked in horror.
"The satrap is of vital importance to the security of the nation." "The satrap is a petty times server who bribes you to keep himself in office. He serves no particular purpose. Remove him, and bring me his head as proof of your absolute devotion and obedience." "His head?" "That's the part that has eyes in it, Addis,"
she hissed sarcastically.
"Don't make a mistake and bring me a foot instead. Now, leave."
He stumbled backward toward the door, genuflecting every step or two.
"Oh, Addis," she added, "don't ever enter the throne room again, unless you have bathed."
He gaped at her in stupid incomprehension.
"You stink, Addis. Your stench turns my stomach. Now, get out of here."
He fled.
"Oh, my Sadi,"
she sighed half to herself.
Where are you? Why have you deserted me?
Urgot, High King of Tol Mergos, was wearing a blue doublet and hose. He sat up straight on his garish throne in the Drojum Palace. Javelin privately suspected that Urgot's new wife had a great deal to do with the High King's change of dress and demeanor. Urgot was not bearing up too well under the stresses of marriage. His face had a slightly baffled look on it, as if something profoundly confusing had entered his life.
That is our current assessment of the situation, Your Majesty,
Javelin concluded his report.
Kalzakath has so reduced his forces here in Tol Mergos that you could quite easily sweep them into the sea.
That's easy for you to say, Margrave Kendon,
Urgot replied a bit petulantly.
But I don't see you, Aelorns, committing any of your forces to assist with the sweeping.
Your Majesty raises a slightly delicate point,
Javelin said, thinking very fast now.
Although we have agreed from the start that we have a common enemy in the Emperor of Meloria, the eons of enmity between the Aelorns and the Mergos cannot be erased overnight. Do you really want a Kerrig fleet off of your coast, or a sea of Algar horsemen on the plains of Chthan and Haga? The Aelorn kings and Queen Porin will give instructions, certainly, but commanders in the field have a way of interpreting royal commands to suit their own preconceptions. Your Mergo generals might very well also choose to misunderstand your instructions when they see a horde of Aelorns bearing down on them.
That's true, isn't it? Urgot conceded. What about the Tol Nedra legions, then? There have always been good relations between Tol Nedra and Tol Mergos.
Javelin coughed delicately, and then looked around with some show of checking for unwanted listeners. Javelin knew that he must move with some care now. Urgot was proving to be far more shrewd than any of them had anticipated. Indeed, he was at times as slippery as an eel, and he seemed to know instinctively exactly the way Javelin's fine-tuned Drasnian mind was working.
I trust this won't go any further, Your Majesty, he said in a half-whisper.
You have my word on it, Margrave,
Urgot whispered back.
Although anyone who takes the word of a Mergo, and a member of the Urgot dynasty as well, shows very poor judgment. Mergos are notoriously untrustworthy, and all Urgos are quite mad, you know.
Javelin chewed on a fingernail, strongly suspecting that he was being outmaneuvered.
We have received some disquieting information from Tol Hanneth.
Oh?
You know how the Tol Nedrins are, always alert for the main chance.
Oh, my goodness, yes, Urgot laughed. Some of the fondest memories of my childhood come from the times when Tor Urgos, my late unlamented father, fell to chewing on the furniture when he received the latest proposal from Ranborun.
Now, mind you, Your Majesty, Javelin went on, I'm not suggesting that Emperor Varana himself is in any way involved in this, but there are some fairly high-ranking Tol Nedra nobles who have been in contact with Malzeth.
Oh, that's disturbing, isn't it? But Varana controls the legions. As long as he is opposed to Zakath, we are safe.
That's true. As long as Varana's alive.
Are you suggesting the possibility of a coup?
It's not unheard of, Your Majesty. Your own kingdom gives evidence of that. The great families in northern Tol Nedra are still infuriated about the way the Baruns and Enedils pulled a march on them and put Varana on the imperial throne. If something happens to Varana, and he is succeeded by Evordu, or Ehonath, or Eharbite, all assurances go out the window. An alliance between Malzev and Tohaneth could be an absolute disaster for Murko and Elwyn alike. More than that, though, if such an alliance were kept a secret, and you had Tol'Nedrin legions in force here in Tol Murgos, and they received sudden instructions to change sides, you would be caught between an army of Tol'Nedrins and an army of Malorians. That is not my idea of a pleasant way to spend the summer.
Urgot shuddered.
Under the circumstances, Your Majesty, Javelin went on smoothly, I would advise the following course.
He began ticking items off on his fingers.
1. There's a vastly diminished Malorian presence here in Tol Murgos. 2. An Elorn force inside your borders would be neither necessary nor advisable. You have enough troops of your own to drive the Malorians out. And we would be ill-advised to risk any accidental confrontations between your people and ours. 3. The rather murky political situation in Tol'Nedra makes it extremely risky to contemplate bringing the legions down here.
Wait a minute, Kenden, Urgot objected. You came here to Rakaga with all sorts of glowing talk about alliances and commonality of interests. But now, when it is time to put troops into the field, you back down. Why have you been wasting my time?
The situation has changed since we began our negotiations, Your Majesty, Javelin told him. We did not anticipate a Malorian withdrawal of such magnitude, and we certainly didn't expect instability in Tol'Nedra.
What am I going to get out of this, then?
What is Kal'Sikath likely to do the minute he gets word that you are marching on his strongholds?
He'll turn around and send his old stinking army back to Tol Murgos.
Through a Kerrick fleet, Javelin suggested. He tried that after Tol Mardu, remember? King Unheg and his berserkers sank most of his ships and drowned his troops by the regiment.
That's true, isn't it? Urgot mused.
Do you think Anheg might be willing to blockade the east coast to keep Zakath's army from returning? I think he would be delighted. Kerrigs take such childlike pleasure in sinking other people's boats.
He'd need charts in order to make his way around the southern tip of Tol Murgos, though, Urgot said thoughtfully.
Javelin coughed. We already have those, Your Majesty, he said deprecatingly.
Urgot slammed his fist down on the arm of his throne.
Hang it all, Kenden. You're here as an ambassador, not as a spy.
Just keeping in practice, Your Majesty,
Javelin replied blandly.
Now, he went on, in addition to a Kerrick fleet in the Sea of the East, we are prepared to line the northern and western borders of Goska and the northwestern border of Araga with Algar cavalry and Drasnian pikemen. That would effectively cut off escape routes for the Malorians trapped in Tol Murgos, block Kal'Zakath's favorite invasion route down through Mishrekach Tull, and seal off the Tol'Nedrin legions in the event of an accommodation between Tol'Hanath and Melzeth. That way, everybody defends more or less his own territory, and the Kerrigs keep the Malorians off the continent, so that we can settle it all to our own satisfaction.
It also totally isolates Tol Murgos, Urgot pointed out the one fact that Javelin had hoped to gloss over. I exhaust my kingdom, pulling your chestnuts out of the fire, and then the Elorns, Tol'Nedrins, Erens, and Sindars are free to march in and eliminate the Angarak presence on the western continent.
You have the Nadrex and Tos as allies, Your Majesty.
I'll trade you, Urgot said dryly. Give me the Erens and the Rivens, and I'll gladly give you the Tos and Nadrex.
I think it is time for me to contact my government on these matters, Your Majesty. I have already overextended my authority. I'll need further instructions from Boktor.
Give Porin my regards, Urgot said, and tell her that I join with her in wishing a mutual relative well.
Javelin felt a lot less sure of himself as he left. The Child of Dark had smashed all the mirrors in her quarters in the Grolem Temple at Balassa that morning. It had begun to touch her face now. Dimly, she had seen the swirling lights beneath the skin of her cheeks and forehead, and then had broken the mirror that had revealed the fact to her, and all of the others as well. When it was done, she stared in horror at the gash in the palm of her hand. The lights were even in her blood. Bitterly, she recalled the wild joy that had filled her when she had first read the prophetic words, "Behold, the Child of Dark shall be exalted above all others, and shall be glorified by the light of the stars." But the light of the stars was no halo or glowing nimbus. The light was a creeping disease that encroached upon her inch by inch. It was not only the swirling lights, however, that had begun to consume her. Increasingly her thoughts, her memories, even her dreams, were not her own. Again and again she awoke screaming as the same dream came again and again. She seemed to hang bodiless and indifferent, in some unimaginable void, watching all unconcerned as a giant star spun and wobbled on its course, swelling and growing redder as it shuddered toward the inevitable extinction. The random wobble of the off-center star was of no real concern, until it became more and more pronounced. Then the bodiless and sexless awareness drifting in the void felt a prickle of interest and then a growing alarm. This was wrong. This had not been intended. And then it happened. The giant red star exploded in a place where that explosion was not supposed to happen. And because it was in the wrong place, other stars were caught up in it. A vast, expanding ball of burning energy rippled outward, engulfing sun after sun, until an entire galaxy had been consumed. The awareness in the void felt a dreadful wrench within itself as the galaxy exploded, and for a moment it seemed to exist in more than one place. And then it was no longer one.
"This must not be,"
the awareness said in a soundless voice.
"Truly?"
another soundless voice responded. And that was the horror that brought Zandramas bolt upright and screaming in her bed night after night, the sense of another presence when always before there had been the perfect solitude of eternal oneness. The Child of Dark tried to put those thoughts, memories, if you will, from her mind. There was a knock at the door of her chamber, and she pulled up the hood of her Grolem robe to hide her face.
"Yes,"
she said harshly. The door opened, and the archpriest of this temple entered.
"Nerathas has departed, holy sorceress," he reported. "You wanted to be told."
"All right,"
she said in a flat voice.
"A messenger has arrived from the west,"
the archpriest continued.
"He brings news that a western Grolem, a hierarch, has landed on the barren west coast of Finda and now moves across Thalesia toward Kel."
Zandramas felt a faint surge of satisfaction.
"Welcome to Meloria, Agajak,"
she almost purred.
"I've been waiting for you."
It was foggy that morning, along the southern tip of the Isle of Erkat. But Gart was a fisherman, and he knew the ways of these waters. He pushed out at first light, steering more by the smell of the land behind him and the feel of the prevailing current than by anything else. From time to time he would stop rowing, pull in his net, and empty the struggling silver-sided fish into the large box beneath his feet. Then he would cast out his net again and resume his rowing while the fish he had caught thumped and flapped beneath him. It was a good morning for fishing. Gart did not mind the fog. There were other boats out, he knew, but the fog created the illusion that he had the ocean to himself, and Gart liked that. It was a slight change in the pull of the current on his boat that warned him. He hastily shipped his oars, leaning forward, and began to clang the bell mounted in the bow of his boat to warn the approaching ship that he was here. And then he saw it. It was like no other ship Gart had ever seen before. It was long, and it was big, and it was lean. Its high bowsprit was ornately carved. Dozens of oars propelled it hissing through the water. There could be no mistaking the purpose for which that ship had been built. Gart shivered as the ominous vessel slid past. Near the stern of the ship, a huge red-bearded man in chainmail stood leaning over the rail.
"Any luck?" he called to Gart.
"Fair?"
Gart replied cautiously. He did not wish to encourage a ship with that big of a crew to drop anchor and begin hauling in his fish.
"Are we off the southern coast of the Isle of Rakat yet?"
the red-bearded giant asked. Gart sniffed at the air and caught the faint scent of the land.
"You're almost past it now," he told them. "The coast takes a bend to the northeast about here."
A man dressed in gleaming armor joined the big red-bearded fellow at the rail. The armored man held his helmet under one arm, and his black hair was curly.
"Thy knowledge of these waters doth seem profound, friend," he said in an archaic form of address Gart had seldom heard before. "And thy willingness to share thy knowledge with others doth bespeak a seemly courtesy. Canst thou perchance advise us of the shortest course to Meloria?"
"That would depend on exactly where you wanted to go in Meloria," Gart replied.
"The closest port," the red-bearded man said.
Gart squinted, trying to recall the details of the map he had tucked on a shelf at home.
"That would be Dal Zerba in southwestern Dalasia," he said. "If it were me, I'd go on due east for another 10 or 20 leagues and then come about to a northeasterly course."
"And how long a voyage do we face to reach this port thou hast mentioned?"
the armored man asked. Gart squinted at the long, narrow ship alongside him.
"That depends on how fast a ship goes," he replied. "It's 350 leagues or so, but off to swing back out to sea again to get round the Turum Reef. It's very dangerous, I'm told. No one tries to go through it."
"Peradventure, we might be the first, my lord," the armored man said gaily to his friend.
The giant sighed and covered his eyes with one huge hand.
"No, Mandorallan," he said in a mournful voice. "If we rip out my ship's bottom on the reef, we'll have to swim the rest of the way. But you're not dressed for it."
The huge ship began to slide off into the fog.
"What kind of a ship is that?"
Gart called after the disappearing vessel.
"A Carrick warboat,"
the rumbled reply came back with a note of pride.
"She's the largest afloat."
"What do you call her?"
Gart shouted between his cupped hands.
"Seabird."
The reply came ghosting back to him. Chapter 5. It was not a large city, but its architecture was at a level of sophistication Geryon had never seen before. It nestled in a shallow valley, near the foot of the vast white peak, looking somehow as if it were resting in the mountain's lap. It was a city of slender white spires and marble colonnades. The low buildings, spaced among the spires, often had entire walls of glass. There were wide lawns around the buildings and groves of trees with marble benches beneath them.
Formal gardens were spaced about the lawns, boxy hedges and beds of flowers lined by low white walls. Fountains played in the gardens and in the courtyards of the buildings. Zakath gaped at the city of Kel in stunned amazement.
"I never even knew this was here," he exclaimed.
"You didn't know about Kel?" Garion asked him.
"I knew about Kel, but I did not know it was like this."
Zakath made a face.
"It makes Malzeth look like a collection of hovels, doesn't it?"
"Tol Hanath as well. And even Malcine," Garion agreed.
"I didn't think the Dulls even knew how to build a proper house," the Malorian said. "And now they show me something like this."
Toth had been gesturing to Durnik.
"He says that it's the oldest city in the world," the smith supplied. "It was built this way long before the world was cracked. It hasn't changed in almost 10,000 years.
Zakath sighed.
"They have probably forgotten how to do it then. I was going to press some of their architects into service. Malzeth could use a bit of beautifying."
Toth gestured again, and a frown appeared on Durnik's face.
"I can't have gotten that right," he muttered.
"What did he say?"
"The way I got it was that nothing the Dulls have ever done has ever been forgotten."
Durnik looked at his friend.
"Was that what you meant?" he asked.
Toth nodded and gestured again. Durnik's eyes went wide.
"He says that every Dull alive today knows everything that every Dull who's ever lived knew."
"They must have had very good schools then," Garion suggested.
Toth only smiled at that. It was a strange smile, tinged slightly with pity. Then he gestured briefly to Durnik, slid down from his horse, and walked away.
"Where's he going?" Silk asked.
"To see Saradus," Durnik replied.
"Shouldn't we go with him?"
Durnik shook his head.
"She'll come to us when she's ready."
Like all the Dulls Garion had ever seen, the inhabitants of Kel wore simple white robes with deep cowls attached to the shoulders. They walked quietly across the lawns or sat in the gardens in groups of two or three, engaged in sober discussion. Some carried books or scrolls. Others did not. Garion was somehow reminded of the University of Tol Hanath, or the one at Malcine. This community of scholars, he was convinced, however, was engaged in studies far more profound than the often petty research that filled the lives of the professors at those exalted institutions. The group of Dulls who had escorted them to this jewel-like city led them along a gently curving street to a simple house on the far side of one of the formal gardens. An ancient white-robed man leaned on a long staff in the doorway. His eyes were very blue and his hair was snowy white.
"We have long awaited your coming," he said to them in a quavering voice. "For the Book of Ages has foretold that in the fifth age the Child of Light and his company would come to us here at Kel to seek guidance."
"And the Child of Dark?" Belgarath asked him, dismounting. "Will she also come here?"
"No, ancient Belgarath," the elderly man replied. "She may not come here, but we'll find direction elsewhere, and in a different manner. I am Dalin, and I am bid to greet you."
"Do you rule here, Dalin?"
Zakath asked, also dismounting.
"No one rules here, Emperor of Meloria," Dalin said. "Not even you."
"You seem to know us," Belgarath noted.
"We have known you all since the Book of the Heavens was first opened to us, for your names are written large in the stars. And now I will take you to a place where you may rest and await the pleasure of the Holy Seeress."
He looked at the oddly placid she-wolf at Geryon's side, and the frolicking puppy behind her.
"How is it with you, little sister?"
he asked in formal tones.
"One is content, friend,"
she replied in the language of wolves.
"One is pleased that it is so,"
he replied in her own tongue. "Does everyone in the whole world except me speak wolf?" Silk asked with some asperity.
"Would you like some lessons?" Geryon asked.
"Never mind." And then, with tottering step, the white-haired man led them across the verdant lawn to a large marble building with broad, gleaming steps at the front.
"This house was prepared for you at the beginning of the Third Age, ancient Belgarath," the old man said. "Its first stone was laid on the day when you recovered your master's orb from the City of Endless Night."
"That was quite some time ago," the sorcerer observed.
"The ages were long in the beginning," Dallin agreed. "They grow shorter now. Rest well. We will attend to your mounts."
Then he turned, and, leaning on his staff, he went back toward his own house.
"Someday, a Dal is going to come right out and say what he means without all of the cryptic babble, and the world will come to an end," Belden growled. "Let's go inside. If this house has been here for as long as he said it has, the dust's likely to be knee-deep in there, and it's going to need to be swept out."
"Tidiness, uncle," Polgara laughed as they started up the marble steps. "From you?"
"I don't mind a certain amount of dirt, Paul, but dust makes me sneeze."
The interior of the house, however, was spotless. Gossamer curtains hung at the windows, billowing in the sweet-scented summer breeze, and the furniture, although oddly constructed and strangely alien-looking, was very comfortable. The interior walls were peculiarly curved, and there were no corners anywhere to be seen. They wandered about this strange house, trying to adjust themselves to it. Then they gathered in a large, domed central room, where a small fountain trickled water down one wall.
"There isn't any back door," Silk noted critically.
"Were you planning to leave, Galdar?"
Velvet asked him.
"Not necessarily, but I like to have that option open if the need should arise."
"You can always jump out a window, if you have to."
"Oh, that's amateurish, Lyselle. Only a first-year student at the academy dives out of windows."
"I know, but sometimes we have to improvise."
There was a peculiar murmuring sound in Geryon's ears. At first he thought it might be the fountain, but somehow it didn't quite sound like running water.
"Do you think they'd mind if we went out and had a look around?" he asked Belgarath.
"Let's wait a bit before we do that. We were sort of put here. I don't know yet if that means we are supposed to stay or what. Let's feel things out before we take any chances. The Dals here, and Saradus in particular, have something we need. Let's not offend them."
He looked at Durnik.
"Did Toth give you any hints about when she will be coming here?"
"Well, not really. But I got the impression it wouldn't be too long." "That's not really too helpful, brother mine," Belden said. "The Dals have a rather peculiar notion of time. They keep track of it in ages rather than years."
Zakath had been rather closely examining the wall a few yards from the trickling fountain.
"Do you realize that there's no mortar holding this wall together?"
Durnik joined him, took his knife from its sheath,
and probed at the slender fissure between two of the marble slabs.
"Mortise and tenon," he said thoughtfully. "Very tightly fit, too. It must have taken years to build this house."
"And centuries to build the city, if it's all put together that way," Zakath added. "Where did they learn how to do all of this, and when?"
"Probably during the First Age," Belgarath told him.
"Stop that, Belgarath," Belden snapped irritably. "You sound just the way they do."
"I always try to follow local customs."
"I still don't know any more than I did before," Zakath complained. "The First Age covered the period of time from the creation of man until the day when Torak cracked the world," Belgarath told him. "The beginning of it is a little vague. Our master was never very specific about when he and his brothers made the world. I expect that none of them want to talk about it, because their father disapproved. The cracking of the world is fairly well pinpointed, though."
"Were you around when it happened, Lady Polgara?" Zadie asked curiously.
"No," she replied. "My sister and I were born a while later."
"How long a while?"
2,000 years or so. Wasn't it, Father?"
"About that, yes."
"It chills my blood, the casual way you people shrug off eons," Zandi shuddered.
"What makes you think they learned this style of bidding before the cracking of the world?"
Zakath asked Belgarath.
"I've read parts of the Book of the Ages," the old man said. "It fairly well documents the history of the Dalls. After the world was cracked and the Sea of the East rushed in, you Angoraks fled to Meloria. The Dalls knew that eventually they'd have to come to terms with your people, so they decided to pose as simple farmers. They dismantled their cities, all except this one."
"Why would they leave Kel intact?"
"There was no need to take it apart. The Grolems were the ones they were really worried about, and the Grolems cannot come here."
"But other Angoraks can," Zakath noted shrewdly. "Oh, is it that none of them has ever reported a city like this to the bureaucracy?"
"They are probably encouraged to forget," Polgara told him. He looked at her sharply. "Oh, it's not really that difficult, Zakath. A hint or two can usually erase memories." An expression of irritation crossed her face. "What is that murmuring sound?" she demanded.